Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 22nd of February, 2023, and this is Reconstruction with me, David Taylor, and him, Phil Bishop, from the Construction Index. And we're here to talk about the various comings and goings in the construction industry over the last fortnight or so. What have we got lined up today?
We've got a few topics, I think, under the broad headlines of US protectionism, concrete, and a couple of concrete stories to talk about. And we'll have a little look ahead to the budget that's coming up next month to see what people are hoping for and what we might actually get. Not that I have any insight, really, but we'll have a little look at
yeah,
that.
Yeah, we can speculate.
But the first of these is prompted by something you posted last week. Tell us about it, David.
Well, yeah, this is a story in the international section of the website. I mean, we don't do an awful lot of international news. Most of our readers are based in the UK, but I think a lot of them like to keep an eye on what's going on in other parts of the world. This is a story about Joe Biden, President of the United States, of course, and his State of the Union address, which he gave at the beginning of this month, early February. He said a lot of things, of course, but the thing which I picked up on was he was talking about, well, the headline is US infrastructure will be built with American-made products, promises Biden. And, you know, this is sort of a tub-thumping type of speech. I mean, the State of the Union address is obviously designed to make everybody feel good about being American. But he promised that, American roads, airports, railways, all the rest of it, all the infrastructure, all the heavy stuff is going to be built using American-made products. But, you know, a lot of people say these things because they want to make the producers of those products feel better about what's coming down the line. But the thing is that he was only restating a promise which was made as early as 1933, because there's an American made act. I can't remember exactly what the act is called as well. Not quite as
I've got it. It's called the Buy American Act.
Oh, it's as simple as that then.
Not to be confused with the more recent Buy America Act.
That's true.
Buy American Act, 1933. It's 90 years old.
Yeah, which required, you know, government purchasers to buy American-made products. And the funny thing is that he said, you know, this has been the law of the land for sort of over 80 years, and yet people have always found a way around it. And it's not really surprising, because I suppose it sounds good as a soundbite, doesn't it? You know, everything's made in America, so, you know, we'll be building our infrastructure and helping our suppliers at the same time. But one or two people were quite willing to pour a bit of cold water on this. One of them gently pointed out that this isn't really practical. Doug Carlson, chief executive of the National Utility Contractors Association, pointed out that our projects require a very complex mix of materials, some of which are not domestically manufactured. Some components are not made in the United States and must be bought overseas to complete the job. Other materials sourced from foreign sources are significantly cheaper and hold down federal government infrastructure expenditures, he added. So it's not a simple case of Buy America and everybody's happy. But I thought it was quite interesting, because I looked into this, and yes, indeed, there is this Buy American Act. And it does require a certain proportion. It's not 100%. I think to qualify, it says that the Act does not limit federal purchasing to 100% US-made products. As long as 55% of their value is manufactured in the United States, then that's okay. So there is some wiggle room there. But America is not, apparently, or so it says, unusually protectionist in this way, because they say that other states, and they particularly notice that the UK, France, Germany and Japan were all mentioned, also have limitations on the amount of foreign products which can be incorporated into government projects. But it's a bit disingenuous because I don't really think that we have anything like the sort of legal requirement to include British-made products in British-made infrastructure. And in fact, we are signed up to, when I say we, I mean the UK, is signed up to the World Trade Organization's Agreement on Government Procurement, which on the government website points out that this gives British businesses access to £1.3 trillion worth of public procurement opportunities overseas. So, you know, it cuts both ways.
I think there's a rather wonderful irony that we always think of America as the, not just the land of the free, but the land of the free market and private enterprise and the cut and thrust of free enterprise. And yet it actually is famously protectionist. It's the confluence of politics, where you want to, you know, protect your national industries, and economics, where you don't want to be propping up something that's basically not up to the job.
Yeah.
And there's an awful lot of trauma in American industry when Japanese motor cars and German motor cars sort of started taking over from the huge, great, big American gas guzzlers from the, I suppose that started in the, probably started in the 70s, but took root in the 90s, I guess, when the profile of the, you know, American highways, the vehicles on them changed. I'm glad to say they've still got the same huge, great trucks, which are distinctive to America, to other
countries.
But you see a lot more Japanese, Korean, German cars on the roads now.
Yeah.
But it's worth noting that we're only talking about government projects, federal government projects. If a private sector development is still free to buy foreign products, foreign components.
Sure.
But this idea that for national infrastructure projects, we're only going to use American products is just jingoistic, isn't it? I mean, it cannot be rational if the better products are made overseas and for the same price.
Yeah, exactly. As this chap from the Utilities Contractors Association pointed out, if you buy better materials cheaper overseas, then you actually save the government money. So it's not as simple as that. I mean, Barack Obama also introduced an act, which I wasn't aware of until I looked into this, which was the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009. And you may remember this because I can remember some to-ing and fro-ing about it in the international news back then. It was all about steel. And he wanted to steel and iron purchasing to be from US producers and not brought from overseas. And I think at about around the same time in the UK, we were worrying about the fact that the Chinese were dominating the supply of steel into the UK. And let's face it, our steel industry isn't what it used to be, folks. But Barack Obama's requirement, which was, you know, all American public sector projects which require steel must buy American steel, that was heavily watered down because people pointed out that American companies were worried about retaliation. Retaliation from other countries. And this is it. You know, if you're going to say, right, we're not going to import steel from China or wherever it is, or cement from Mexico, we're going to only buy our own stuff, then China and Mexico and all the other countries that are now ruled out of supplying America are going to say, right, well, we're not going to buy American cars or American guns or whatever it might be. So, you know, they can retaliate. Everybody has to sort of find a way of living, haven't they? They've got to find a way of doing equal trade. And if anybody has a big advantage, then there are ways of retaliating against that. And
but we had some similar pronouncement from our own government. It may have been 5 years ago, but I think it's only a couple of years ago, and I can't remember who the Prime Minister was that week, that there'd be a Buy British Steel drive. Just, you know, the steel industry is,
yes,
was then, still is, in crisis. And there's a big push that we should only buy British steel. Which brings on to the next thing is, what is British steel? The British steel industry is owned by India and it's owned by China. So, yes, it's British jobs that are being saved, but at the end of the day, any profit that they should happen to make will leave the country.
Yeah.
And so, like, so many products have no definable nationality, really. I mean, we think of JCB as very British, but they've got factories in America. They'll be able to say, well, no, it's American jobs that are being saved if the American government buys JCBs rather than Caterpillar products.
Yeah.
I mean, clearly to you and I, JCB is British, but in, I mean, I think it probably does got more employees in India than in Britain. It's huge in India.
I wouldn't be surprised. But then also, you look at what these, all the heavy steel fabrication is done in the UK, maybe, but they're buying in electronic components and various other components from Germany, Japan, Korea, and other places. So there'll be, or there'll always be a certain imported element in a what we would consider to be 100% British-made product.
Yes.
And in fact, there is a procurement bill actually going through Parliament at the moment. I found a guide to it, which was published in June last year. Had a quick skim through it, and there was nothing. There's a lot of talk about fair procurement and making sure that SMEs don't get, you know, sidelined and that they get a fair bite of the cherry.
We've talked about this before. This is more social value guff, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, but it says nothing about limiting the amount of imported products in public sector procurement. It does actually draw attention to the agreement, the World Trade Organization's agreement, which I just mentioned.
But part of the whole social value stuff is designed to be a way that if you're a government purchaser and, you know, 20 years ago you're told to take the lowest bid, save money. And therefore you had to buy the stuff from, overseas that was coming in on the cheap and might not be quite as good as our British stuff, but still just about scraped through and met the standards. Yeah. Now they're being told, no, you don't have to take the lowest bid. You are legally allowed to take a high bid if you can make the sums look like all those school visits and social value and stuff that's being done in the local area have a financial value. Which is why every bloody press release we get these days is not explaining how clever construction companies are at building things and designing things and all the good work that they're doing. It's all about how many school visits they're doing and aren't we great with our social value and how many baskets of fruit they took around to the local hospital last week.
Yeah, those things count. Those things really count now.
Yeah. Which is nothing to do with the actual, you know, product or process. It's just to get you on the score sheet. So that's our form of protectionism. Social value is British protectionism.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting slant. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't know whether or not the Americans would take a similar sort of view. I don't know what their social value policies are. But yeah, there's Biden saying that we must, you know, use, or the Americans must use more American products in their public infrastructure projects. So good luck to him. Just getting back to that, the fact that in actual fact, the law requires federal procurement to be 55% of the value of domestic production. Biden has been and is trying to nudge that up because last year he updated the rules with the intent to direct more of the $600 billion spent by the US government on goods and services each year towards creating domestic jobs and industry. And the first step was to increase the qualifying US content to 60%. That happened last year. And the threshold will now increase to 65% next year and 75% in 2029. So he is nudging it up towards that 100% American-made products. Whether or not that, I mean, you know, what happens next year and in 2029, the policy might have changed. But anyway, it's going in that direction. He means it when he says he wants American-made products to be used for American infrastructure projects.
There are always ways around it. The various products in the grocery section of supermarkets, which, you know, have got a sort of a "this comes from Britain" stamp, whereas actually what comes from Britain is the wrapping or the packaging or some little tiny added value that's come from Britain, but the actual stuff doesn't necessarily.
Well, I had a friend who worked for a fashion house as a buyer, or actually he was in import export, not necessarily buying, and they sold rather smart Italian made clothes. Italian-made clothes made in Thailand, actually. They were made in Thailand, shipped to Milan, where they had the label sewn into them, and then came over here as American.
Exactly what I'm talking about. Yeah. Exactly that, yes.
Okay, well, that's protectionism. What's next on the agenda? Are we ready to move on to another topic?
Yeah, I want to talk about concrete.
Yeah, why not?
And I think we've got a couple of things on this. Not the isn't concrete awful and bad for the environment thing, which people like us tend to bang on about. But first of all, I want to talk about a research project which a couple of British universities have been involved with, University of East Anglia and the University of Central Lancashire. But it's a French-led project looking at how to make concrete road surfaces more permeable. This is an environmental thing to avoid the water runoff from concrete roads. Want to get it through the material. And they've come up with a way of making the road surface material with seashells. And the idea is it's a recycled material, environmentally friendly material. Instead of, you know, dredging for sand and aggregate, you're using seashells. And apparently it works. They've done a few pilot sites in France where when it rains, the water goes nicely through the road. And I mean, I don't suppose we know what the life expectancy of the surface is yet, but there's a photo of the carriageway we've posted on our site, the Construction Index. And it looks like a road. And or rather good.
But it raises so many questions in my mind, not least of which is, does it have the worst possible acronym I've seen, for certainly so far this year? It's called, the project is called CIRCLE. And this is the first thing I noticed about it, actually, was the project is called CIRCLE, C-I-R-C-L-E, as you would expect to spell it. And it stands for Concrete Solution Draining for the Climate and Environment. And of course, the R in draining is capped up to make CIRCLE. They could have come up with something else, I'm sure, but that's what they've got, CIRCLE.
Well, it may be a lot better in its native French.
Probably.
It may actually, the French may actually work as an acronym. Yeah. It's just been hackneyed, translated into English.
I don't understand it. I mean, I read your story, which I think was a fair summary of it. And I also looked at a couple of the websites of the organisations that are running this project.
Well, we'll tell people, project-circle.eu.
Yes, yes.
Is the way you can find out more about it. Yeah.
But for a start, I mean, I don't know. First of all, how do they make the concrete permeable? Is it because seashells are jagged and angular and there are voids in them, which you wouldn't get if you're using, say, gravel, which tends to be sort of fairly spherical and therefore not full of voids? Also, what sort of shells do they use? Because I imagine that your average winkle or whelk would produce quite a sort of hard aggregate if you ground it down. But a crab, your crustaceans, I think, are out. You've got to go for the mollusks because they've got the hard sort of limestone shells. But you know, you couldn't make a road out of prawn shells, for example. You could make stock out of it, but you couldn't make a road out of it. And does it use cement? I mean, because they're saying, but they're not actually pushing the zero carbon message for once. But they are talking about it being better for the environment. So does it use cement as a normal concrete mixture would use cement? I assume it must do. And where, and the biggest question maybe is, where are they getting all these shells from? I mean, maybe in France, where they consume a lot of shellfish and seafood, maybe they've got a lot of these shells just knocking around, but people in this country don't tend to use them so much or eat them so much.
University of Central Lancashire's in Preston. That's not far from Morecambe Bay.
That's true, yeah. They get plenty of whelks. No, not whelks. Cockles. They get in Morecambe Bay, don't they? Famous for their cockles. A cockle would make good aggregate, I reckon. But is there a... People don't tend to throw away their winkle shells or their oyster shells or their mussel shells anywhere else except in the black bin. I mean, maybe the producers, you know, the processors of seafood do produce large amounts of shell, but I would have thought you need an awful lot to build a road. I mean, I wouldn't have thought there were that many seashells going spare that we could actually turn into concrete.
Well, we can find out next week, 28th of February. There'll be the final event of this research project. It's taking place in Norwich at the UEA. So I always write UAE, which is a different place altogether.
Yeah, yes,
UEA, University of East Anglia in Norwich.
Yeah.
This final presentation, where I think a lot of these issues and questions will be answered. And
yeah.
If you're sufficiently interested, go to project-circle or -circle.eu. You can sign up to, I suppose, you know, remotely attend this presentation, I think, and find out how it works and what the Norwich Business School has come up with business models to support the adoption and marketing of this new concrete product.
Yeah.
But you clearly think it's fishy and that the admixture is Thousand Island dressing to hold it all together.
I think I probably will dial into that presentation if I can find a way of doing so, because, as I say, I've got lots of questions about it. I'd be interested to find out more. Main question is where they're getting the shells from and how do they make the road surface permeable. So I think it's worth following up. I'll definitely do that.
I'd like to know how long they think it'll last for.
Yeah, well, that is another good question, of course.
I'd also like to know whether they need different machinery to lay it and maintain it.
Yeah.
Actually, we've got lots of questions.
We've got lots of questions.
It's our job, though, isn't it?
Yeah. Anyway.
But that's interesting, fun, slightly off the mainstream. But our next concrete topic is equally interesting, not at all fun, very serious. It's been rumbling for a few years now. Talk us through it, David.
This is a product or a material that I wasn't all that familiar with. In fact, I didn't really know about the particular products involved here. It's autoclaved aerated concrete, reinforced autoclaved aerated concrete, in actual fact. I mean, I think a lot of people will be familiar with sort of those lightweight aero type concrete blocks, very lightweight sort of foam concrete blocks, which are used for usually non-load bearing purposes in wall construction, that kind of thing. Very, very lightweight.
These blocks are you talking about?
Yeah, I think so. Well, I think people often call solid concrete blocks freeze blocks. I don't know what you call them. You know, the sort of thing that I think H&H Selcon make, this foam concrete. Basically, I mean, I'm sure everybody knows what I'm talking about, even though I'm being very inarticulate. But it's this concrete product. The material doesn't have any big aggregate in it, maybe a bit of sand. It has some, I think it's aluminium silicate or something like that, which reacts with either the cement or the sand in the mix. And it just swells up, just like a cake rising in the oven. So you get this lightweight foam concrete. It's very good. It's got a very good thermal insulation properties. But back in the day,
and we're talking about planks here, aren't we?
Yeah, because
the reinforced autoclaved aerated concrete, they look like planks of wood, except they're made of light concrete.
Yeah, exactly. And I've heard of them being built somewhere. I read about them being manufactured up to 6 meters in length, but they're basically like floor slabs. So they're you know, they span between either steel or concrete supports at either end, and they were used a lot in the, I think, from the 1950s through to the mid 90s, and they were used a lot for lightweight construction in specifically schools. This is where the focus is at the moment, school construction, but they were also used in other buildings,
hospitals as well. There've been a couple of failures in hospitals.
Thing is that they only had a design life of about, I think it's about 30 years, something like that.
And their time's up.
Yeah, their time is up. And so they're in schools all over the country, and there's been one or two incidents. I mean, there was a school, I think in Essex, might have been in Kent, where a ceiling actually collapsed in a classroom. Luckily, it was out of school hours and nobody was hurt, but it did a lot of damage. And it collapsed without any warning, and that's the problem. These things are, you've got this foam concrete, which is pretty porous, and to make these concrete planks actually load bearing, they need steel reinforcement inside them. And being porous, the moisture inevitably sort of seeps into it, and you get the usual problem which you get with old reinforced concrete, which is the rebar tends to rust and weakens the concrete, and in the end it just collapses. And this has happened particularly because these planks were used in a lot of flat roof constructions, and they've been generally weakening over the years. And then along comes a contractor to renew the flat roofing membrane or whatever it is that's keeping all the water out. So they're up there putting this new membrane on this dodgy roof, and the extra loading is too much for it because it's weakened to such an extent that it can't support anything more than its own weight, and that's what causes the collapse. So there's been the government actually has sort of woken up to this. I think last year there were rumblings about this problem, which was obviously in the offing. This was following that collapse, obviously. And since then, the government has actually...
I want to come in here and stress that. Hello, Pussycat. Your cat's just made an appearance behind you, David. Lovely to see.
She's gone again.
I want to interrupt at this point. So I posted something just before Christmas. I had a look at the... actually, I think it's probably the... It might have been The Guardian or flagged us up first, but maybe go have a look at the Department for Education's annual report. This is the year 2021 to 2022, year ending, whatever it is, end of March 22, annual report. And they said that the risk of schools collapsing has increased from likely to very likely in that year, as more structural faults are found. Now, this is not just these concrete planks that are collapsing, but this seems to be the main thing. The risk predominantly exists in those buildings built in the years 1945 to 1970, which used system build light frame techniques. So very likely, the risk of schools very likely. And I just think, I mean, we're talking modern methods of construction here, of course, a bit like rain screen cladding. Yes. And there's been this hugely high profile public, you know, cladding scandal and all sorts of issues associated with that, because so many people died in the Grenfell Tower fire. Fortunately, I think people have escaped broadly. I may be wrong, but there hasn't been a high profile fatality, I don't think, involved in a school collapse or a hospital collapse involving these concrete panels.
No.
But if there had been, and it could have happened at any time over the past 10 years, it seems to me, because we've known about it for quite a while, that it would have been a much, much bigger national scandal. That what are we doing building with this stuff which hasn't got a sufficient design life? And the people who are, there are all sorts of other new methods of construction being used. And you say, what's the design life? And they don't answer. They're deaf. And they won't hear that question at all. And I think there are not enough questions being asked about the design of things they're putting up, because the chickens that are coming home to roost with reinforced autoclaved aerated concrete are perhaps also there waiting for us with other products and systems that we're using.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just time after time after time. You know, Ronan Point. Ronan Point was not RAAC beams. Different system build, but yeah.
But we know about Ronan Point and we know about Grenfell Tower because of what happened there. But of course, that was too late. You know, people were killed. And we don't know much about, at least the general public doesn't know much about reinforced autoclaved aerated concrete, which is a bit of a mouthful, because nobody's been killed by it yet. But, you know, that's, if it's very likely that there will be more failures, then the risk is clearly... high. I mean, the government, the Department of Education, has actually sent out a note to all the estates managers, you know, people who look after school buildings and other buildings which might be affected, saying, you know, go and look for it and do something about it if you find the stuff. They've got a document which actually has a very helpful flow chart in it, you know, what to do, where to start looking and what to do with whatever you find. But one of the problems, of course, is that this stuff is seldom all that visible, because if it's a roof structure, then it will have a membrane over the top of it, so you don't necessarily know what's underneath. And if it's a ceiling, it'll almost certainly have either plasterboard or some other sort of suspended ceiling underneath it. It might be painted. It might even be plastered over. So you might not even know. So they're saying you've got to get a screwdriver or something and poke about, do a little bit of destructive testing to find out what you're dealing with. So it's not a problem that you can very quickly identify. You've got to adopt a methodical process and actually, you know, devote some time and attention to investigating this product, this problem. You might find that you haven't got the problem, but you can't just sit back on your laurels and say, oh, I'm sure we're fine. I mean, the government does say that if the building was if the building was erected after the mid-1990s or before the mid-1940s, it's very unlikely that this product is there. And I think it's probably safe to assume that you're not in danger. But from the mid-1940s through to the mid-1990s is a long time. And a lot of buildings, yeah, as we know, a lot of school buildings were built within that period. Perhaps even the majority of them, if you look at some of the modern schools we have now, post-war schools. So, you know, it's quite likely that there's a lot of this stuff out there which we don't know about, and we need to find out about it before it starts falling on kids' heads.
The two sources I would direct people to, the Local Government Association has got some quite a lot of good stuff on this on its website, but best of all is the Standing Committee on Structural Safety, whose website is cross-safety.org. Fabulous organisation. They've got masses on this. All the reports, all the whistleblowers who have, you know, reported where things have been found. Yeah. A 1990s hospital building has been found to have these planks, which is later than they thought. Most of the, you know, they thought most of the applications were older than this, and that was just from August last year. That report. And there's a whole load of stuff on the crosssafety.org website on this, which is well worth looking at.
Right, okay.
But the problem with one of the issues with the schools is at the moment we've got teachers going on strike and the government saying, oh yeah, but we've given local authorities more money for schools, and they're saying, yeah, but you know, that's for schools themselves, school buildings, school safety, and there's no money the teachers' pay rises to come out of that. No. And I think that's right. I mean, frankly, I'd rather schools stayed safe than teachers got a pay rise. It'd be lovely if all things could happen.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're a local education authority and it's an either-or scenario, teachers are not going to get a pay rise.
Well, no, that's absolutely true. I mean, obviously the whole question of teachers' pay is a can of worms I don't particularly want to open at the moment. But I mean, I'm sure that any teacher would consider it not to be a winning position to have suitable cost of living remuneration, but have a ceiling fall on her or him. You know, it just doesn't. If you know what I mean. What I'm saying is, it doesn't matter how much you're paid. You don't want a concrete plank falling on your head. So first things first, really. So an interesting one, and a problem which I was completely unaware of until you ran that story. I think it was actually, going back to what I said earlier, I think it was 2018 that the government first started alerting people to this problem. It wasn't last year. And I think it was 2018 when that school ceiling collapsed.
And if you want to know why we're talking about it now, folks, it's fairly localised news, Peg. It's just that we reported this week that West Lothian Council has approved £10 million spend to fix three primary schools which have got this problem.
Yeah.
So that's why we're talking about it now, because we've not really had the opportunity to talk about it before, and it's a hugely important issue.
Yeah. Okay, are we going to move on to another topic now?
Well, yeah, talking of spending money on teachers' pay rises and public sector, we've got a budget coming up next month.
Yes, indeed.
I think it's the 15th of March it's set for. These things seem to be fairly set in stone, so barring anything completely extraordinary happening, it will take place on the 15th of March. Be Jeremy Hunt's second budget, had his mini budget in the autumn after he took over as Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Yeah.
Got no idea what he's going to say, but I read that he's got more wiggle room because of energy prices have come down, yeah. Gas prices have come down. He's suddenly got £11 billion extra that he wasn't expecting to have. And that might help pay for some public sector pay rises, although they'll be below inflation, but they'll help.
I think it'd be pretty tight-fisted with it, though. I can't see him doling out money to anybody very quickly.
No, not sure. I'd want him to be too rash with it. It's my money, after all.
Yeah.
Tiny bit of it. Some of it's even yours, I think.
Yeah, I believe so.
But what I'm interested in is when you get all the construction industry, trade associations, invested interests and lobby groups, you know, come up and say, give us more money, or, you know, give us a rebate, tax us less, loosen burdens on us, whatever. And everyone's got their axe to grind and their battles to fight.
Sure.
And the Construction Plant Hire Association has been on the front line of this in the past few years, because famously one of the biggest budget decisions having a direct impact on the construction industry was the abolition of, or the end of, the rebate for diesel fuel in the construction industry. Construction
red diesel.
No longer use red diesel.
Yeah.
And this was a huge blow to the industry, cost to the industry, which it seems to have soaked up. And we've spoken before about how this has prompted a lot of people to run to or switch to HVO, hydrotreated vegetable oil, non-fossil fuel-based diesel replacement.
Yeah.
Even though HVO is actually more expensive, it's taxed at the same rate as diesel, and it's inherently more expensive to buy.
Which is interesting in itself, because a lot of construction companies have actually taken that on the chin. They've said, we're going to pay a little bit extra, but we're going to go green. And I think, as we mentioned before, there is a sort of a green benefit, isn't there, to actually saying that, you know, we've got low carbon fuel in our machines. It's easier to win work if you can actually prove that. But I mean, and we've also mentioned that HVO fuel isn't without its critics, Balfour Beatty being probably the most prominent one. There are questions about its sustainability and palm oil and all the rest of it. But anyway, it does produce fewer emissions. It's not a fossil fuel. And the CPA, the Construction Plant Hire Association, is saying, you know, this is a transitionary technology, and our members are committed to reducing their carbon footprints, and this is a step in the right direction.
So, what they're saying is they want a tax rebate for HVO.
Basically, they
temporarily
want the red diesel rebate to be transferred to HVO. Yeah.
Which I think sounds perfectly reasonable and good, that HVO should be, you know, it should be cheaper, there should be more of an incentive to switch to it, even though, as we've discussed at some length, there are question marks about the sustainability of HVO. All the stuff being used at the moment, most of it, appears to be certified as coming from good places rather than bad places, but that cannot continue indefinitely, and the CPA recognise that. Incidentally, you mentioned Balfour Beatty being an opponent of HVO. The Environment Agency is also, we've reported before, reported last September that they're reviewing their position on it, and have basically been telling people to hold off using it pending this review. I have twice emailed the Environment Agency, including this week, saying, any green, white, black smoke coming out of your review, any conclusions reached? Not an answer. I'm going to have to pick up the telephone and actually make them say, we're not going to tell you, or we don't know. I think it's long grass time.
Yeah.
I think they don't want to get involved in the debate, it seems to me.
Yeah.
They're ducking it.
Yes, they are. And it's, in a way, it's a bit embarrassing for the Environment Agency, because, you know, as it says on the tin, they are concerned with the environment. And what they say about HVO is going to be pretty influential. If the Environment Agency says don't use HVO, that doesn't look as if it's getting an environmental thumbs up, does it?
No.
But I think the thing is that, you know, we're talking about a different government department here. We're talking about the Treasury. And I do think that it was entirely reasonable for the CPA and other organisations in the construction industry to say, look, you know, you're taking away our red diesel rebate, which was, you know, considerable. And there, I can't remember the percent, was it 17% increase in fuel costs overnight something like that.
I think it's more than that. I can't remember.
It was a lot. It was a lot. And
more like 30.
But they've taken it. They've taken it on the chin. And I think that seeing as they were getting a rebate for red diesel, it was a bit mean of Rishi Sunak, who was a chancellor at the time when this decision was made, to say no, you can't have the rebate on green fuel instead, because I think that was pretty unfair.
The thing is, though, if the Treasury accedes to this request and gives even a temporary tax rebate to HVO, where does that leave Balfour Beatty? Because the government is saying, we endorse this fuel, and Balfour Beatty is saying, well, no. I mean,
that's a good question. But I don't think he will. I don't. Having ignored calls from the industry when the red diesel rebate was being withdrawn, I don't think they're going to revisit the question now and say, oh, well, all right, then you can have the rebate back, but only on HVO. I just don't think that's going to happen. You know, good luck to Kevin Minton and his colleagues at the CPA. And I think that I would back his call, but I don't think that Jeremy Hunt is going to listen, quite honestly.
The other tax issue that the Construction Plant and Hire Association is lobbying on was another reform introduced by Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister, when he was Chancellor.
Yeah.
It was Rishi Sunak who ended the red diesel, the diesel rebate for construction when he was Chancellor. He also introduced something called the super deduction allowance, which is one of Rishi Sunak's more imaginative, not quite up there with eat out to help out, but one of his more imaginative incentives to promote investment in machinery, to give people tax breaks on buying machinery. And everyone's first reaction, yay, great. Trouble is, it wasn't all that great for construction industry, because most of the machinery in the construction industry is bought by hire companies, yep, and leasing companies, effectively, who don't actually use the machinery themselves. And that, because they didn't use the machinery themselves, it was used by end user contractors, they didn't get the benefit of this this super deduction allowance. And anyway, the super deduction allowance had some impact, been good for a lot of people. It comes to an end. It expires imminently, this year, next year. This year, end of next month, it expires. And they're saying, could you renew it, please? And could you include us?
Yes.
They want it relaxed so that plant hire companies can benefit from it, and to give it another year or two.
Yeah.
So that would be a good thing.
I think I'm with the CPA on this as well, actually. I think when they introduced the super deduction, I assumed that plant hirers would be the main beneficiaries in the construction industry, because they're probably the people
who buy
most of the equipment. But no, they weren't. And there was this ridiculous sort of, I don't know, I thought it was sort of weasel words, really, that there's HM Revenue and Customs made no distinction between leasing and hiring. And there clearly is a distinction. I mean, if you lease a product, like if you lease a car, that's basically your car, and you use it. But if you hire a mini excavator for 2 weeks on a job site, that's not the same as leasing. You know, it's not your mini excavator. You're just paying somebody to borrow it, to lend it to you, in other words. And so really the owner of the equipment is the plant hirer, not the person using it. And therefore, I think it was entirely unreasonable for them to exclude plant hirers from the super deduction. The other thing is, I'm not sure that the super deduction actually did what it was supposed to do particularly well, because I think it was supposed to stimulate people into buying more capital equipment and pumping more money into the economy. And I'm not sure that it actually achieved that, or if it did, maybe not to the extent that it was expected to. And the fact that it only ran for a year, was it 2 years?
No, it's more, two or three, I thought.
Yeah, two or three.
Certainly more than one.
Yeah. Well, it seems to have gone by very quickly, I have to say that. I don't know, maybe it didn't run long enough for it to actually have any appreciable effect. Good idea, but I think that it was flawed.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah.
We will no doubt return to the subject of the budget after the budget, which will be our two podcasts away at the back end of March.
Okay, well, there'll be other things in the budget, and of course we'll have a deluge of announcements from all the interested parties in the construction industry to wade through on the afternoon of the 15th of March, and no doubt we can bring some of those results and comments to our readers, listeners.
They'll all say the same thing. Yeah. We applaud the Chancellor, but it's a missed opportunity.
Yes,
and
that's right.
Have done more. That's what they'll all say.
You could start writing it now, actually, Phil.
Yeah. Any other business, David?
I think that's about it, actually. I was going to announce that the March issue of the magazine will be out soon. Well, it will be out soon. It will be out at the beginning of March. Goes to press tomorrow, folks. And you can read about reinforced autoclaved aerated concrete, amongst other things, in that issue of the magazine.
Excellent. I look forward to it. Okay, well, then for now, it only remains for me to say thank you, everyone, for listening once again to Reconstruction, the podcast of the Construction Index. And David and I will be back with you again in a couple of weeks. So thank you and cheerio.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.